Hello. Okay. I am Ian Williams. I am president of the Foreign Press Association for my many sins. And our guest today is Alexander Gorbachev, who has recently, yesterday in fact, arrived in Istanbul from Moscow. And for reasons which should become apparent, it was inadvisable. When we discussed it with him, I have to say that Alexander was very brave, saw the consequences and still agreed to do it, to talk about the plight or the position of the press in Putin's Russia. And it was with a great deal of relief for our consciences that he got to Istanbul, because we were going to go ahead and we still worried for him and the consequences. I might add, have to put a public health warning up front. Alexander points out that Gorbachev is a very common Ukrainian name and is no more significant than Smith or Williams for any relation to Gorbachev of that ilk. So he's got no, how should we say, he doesn't have any protection or particular targeting, no relation to the other Gorbachev. But more to the point, he's a former Foreign Press Association awardee. We gave him our prize in 2016, and he went to the University of Missouri. He'd interned at Newsweek, and he's worked for various documentary and news services in Russia during a time when the avenues for real news in Russia have been increasingly choked off. And as he left, of course, the Kremlin was closing the last independent television station. And I have to say that apart from demonstrations in the streets of Petrograd and Moscow, it's been very heartening to see, to watch that the whole staff resigned rather than become a Kremlin propaganda outfit. I rather wish some American station staff would follow the same principled position. But Alexander, I mean, how difficult was it to leave? Were there any inhibitions, apart from personal inhibitions, were there any interference in getting out?
No, there wasn't, even though it seems that these days it's kind of, it's a question of chance, basically, and it's a question of if a guy at the border wants to talk to you or he doesn't. Most people, I don't know any cases that when people weren't let out of Russia, but many people got detained for some time. They were questioned, their phones were looked through, you know, for like messages they were talked to regarding, you know, what do you think of Ukraine, where are you going, why are you leaving, blah blah blah. But I think that's just kind of intimidation. So far, at least, I haven't heard of any cases when people weren't able to leave eventually. And everybody, I think, made their flights, even though, again, like these days, because of all these sanctions by Boeing and Airbus, most of Russian, I think probably all Russian airlines stopped operating beyond the border of Russia. So many people weren't just able to leave because their flights were canceled. So for us, I mean, I left together with my family, my wife, beautiful wife, and my beautiful child. And we didn't encounter any problems, probably because we have a toddler. And and we are not that noticeable, I guess. So we left actually, like, it was all very pretty easy. I mean, but of course it was like huge stress and stuff, because
so have you abandoned your home completely, or are you keeping it mothballed?
What, sorry?
Have you abandoned your apartment and home completely, or have you sort of mothballed?
No. I mean, that it wouldn't be possible in like 2 days, because we decided that we got the tickets on Wednesday and we left on Friday, and the war started like the Thursday before that. So it would have been possible. My wife's mother lives there with our cat, actually. I mean, when we know where we're going to resettle, and if we're resettling, I don't know. I mean, now it's all up in the air. I think we are slowly getting to realize that it is unlikely that we will be able to return in the near future. But I don't think we have already come to terms with this completely. So, but yeah, if and when we settle, we hope that our cat will come to live with us too. Because I think, a good thing about Russia is that maybe it's not only about Russia, but in situations like this, like, almost immediately many businesses come up that, you know, help you to solve the problems that you encounter when you leave. You know, like, they offer to transport your stuff, they offer to transport your pets, stuff like that. So yeah, but yeah, for now, our apartment, I mean, I have a relatively big vinyl collection, because I've been a music journalist for many years. So that's a question too, where will we just sell it, or if we manage to transport it to another city, we'll see. It's all, I mean, it's just too early to think about it now, because it's, I mean, we just arrived here 2 days ago, and then we're going to the next place, and we'll see how it all.
Questions that people are interested, what has it been like working as a journalist? Because obviously Putin is a little like the former president of the United States. It's not just the message. He actually seems to dislike journalists and journalism as an institution. What have been the constraints for the last year on working?
Let me figure out where to start. I mean, I don't think a comparison with Trump works in any way, because basically, I mean, in the United States, the president has to deal with the press. Even if he doesn't like journalists or whatever, it's still, you know, like, First Amendment works, fortunately, for you guys. In Russia, there is no First Amendment, unfortunately. But even though the Constitution does say something about the freedom of press, but the government forgot about it long ago. So I don't know what Putin thinks about journalists. I don't think that he has like a special attitude to them. I don't think he dislikes them or whatever. He has the decisive method, the decisive method of control, of media control, which is television, all the Russian television. And you mentioned this last independent TV station. It's called Dozhd. It's important to remember that it was basically available only on the internet, because it was even cut off from the cable networks many years ago. So it's not it was the last independent TV station, but you couldn't access it if you just, you know, switch on the television in Russia. And if you switch on the television in Russia, it's all propaganda, basically. I don't think Putin cared that much about journalists, and I don't think that's his biggest problem right now. As far as I can see, like, they did block everything, and they do want, obviously, that only the voice of the government is heard within Russia. But I think they're more concerned right now with, you know, like, with dealing with the elites who are fleeing, just as us, basically, because like the elites are used to, many in the elites are used to living in a European city, basically Moscow or St. Petersburg, and now it's over. There will be no restaurants, there will be no shops, there will be nothing, or there will be something but completely different. So elites are fleeing, capital are fleeing, and they are trying to stop this. So this is about Putin. How did it feel to work as an independent journalist for the last years? I mean, it wasn't as bad as you can imagine. And I mean, at least comparing with what's happening now, it seems that, you know, like in February, we had a great life, even though it's not true at all, of course, because in the last 2 years, government started to clamp down on the independent media. So they passed in 2016, I think they passed this foreign agent law that basically requires anybody who is considered the foreign agent by the government to put this huge disclaimer on every message they share anywhere. So basically on Twitter, Telegram, Facebook, on the website, if your TV station like Dosht was on the air, you always have to have this in capital letters, very huge announcement that this, and it's Weberg, it's basically language, it's long, it says, you know, the message is made by an entity deemed a foreign agent, blah blah blah, like that. Like it's like, I don't know, like 50 words or something. It's very long.
We as the Foreign Press Association, as the Foreign Press Association, warned.
Past 2016, and at first, I mean, just some non-governmental organization.
As the Foreign Press Association, we warn the State Department and others that when they banned Russia Today and Press TV and Al Jazeera, made them put the foreign agent registration stuff through, that they were risking retaliation like this, because
they always cite the American law about foreign agents, even though it's nowhere near like Russia Today is a registered foreign agent in the United States, but it doesn't, this law doesn't make them, you know, do all this stuff, doesn't make them, it's also a lot of bureaucracy. And the problem is, another problem is, not only an organization can be labeled a foreign agent, a person can be, and then you have to basically reconfigure all your finances, because you have to do this paperwork each month about all your expenses, and if you don't, you risk a criminal case. So first you risk a fine, and then if you, by law, if you do it twice, if you like do, for example, your paper or paperwork wrong twice, you could be criminally prosecuted. There weren't many cases when people were criminally prosecuted for doing this stuff, but still, it's a huge risk. So in the last 2 years, I think, starting from last spring, in the last year, actually, they started, like, before that, there were just a handful of organizations, most of them not media. I think one of the few media outlets that were labeled a foreign agent before last spring was actually Radio Liberty. Is it called financed by the State Department? So we thought, okay, well, I mean, this is a good media outlet. I have friends that work there. They do good job, but you know, you couldn't understand the reasons why they label it foreign agent, because it is financed by the State Department, blah, blah, blah. But then last spring, they started just throw this label around like to everybody. So Medusa, which is probably the biggest independent digital media in Russian language, which I worked for in 2016, from 2016 until 2019, They were labeled a foreign agent, and then they started to label everybody. Like basically, I mean, that, this register has now 120, I think, entries. So practically everybody. I mean, I now work for a small, relatively small publication called Holod, which is the cold in English, and it isn't labeled a foreign agent, but our editor-in-chief is a foreign agent, and she's been living in Georgia, the country, not the state, for the last year, because her former boyfriend was he is a journalist. He was arrested for treason, and he wrote about, you know, defense stuff and Roscosmos, so Russian space organization. So two years ago, he was like out of nowhere arrested and accused of treason, and he's been in prison ever since. They didn't even, I think the trial hasn't even started yet, and he's been in like prison, mostly in solitary confinement for almost 2 years. And he's former boyfriend of our editor-in-chief. So she left the country even before she was labeled a foreign agent. So and there are many stories like that. And they're all awful, especially if you're like looking from the outside and it looks like it was unbearable, but it wasn't, honestly. I mean, you could work as a journalist in Russia and write about, write good stories, write truthful stories, write interesting stories. There were some subjects that were sure to give you some problems. Maybe, like, for example, Chechnya, which is a whole lot of different story. But if you write about Chechnya, you risk your life, basically, because this is some kind of a wild, wild region where there are no laws. I mean, let's not delve into that because it's a really it's a reason.
Looking at the pictures of Grozny just after went into, it looks like it was a trial run for Kharkiv and Luhansk and the other places.
Yes. Well, I mean, no. Chechnya is a very, very complicated subject. But basically, it was dangerous to write about Chechnya. It still is, and everybody knows that. Then it was, and this, I mean, now everything is dangerous, but it was dangerous to write about Putin's family. So people who did investigations of his family money, his daughters, because he doesn't even like publicly accept that his daughters are his daughters, as you might know. They were labeled not even a foreign agent, but an undesirable organization, which is another thing that makes you criminal immediately. Basically, you have to like, there is this label by the government that is literally called an undesirable organization, which is like sounds like something from Harry Potter, but it's literally an undesirable organization. And until yesterday, there was one media organization that was proclaimed an undesirable organization. It was called Project. It started by Roman Badanin, who is one of the most successful Russian journalist investigators. And he, I think, is a recipient of Knight Fellowship. And he started this media project, the project after he finished his Knight Fellowship and in Stanford. And they did a lot, they like specifically investigated Putin and his nearest circle. So they were proclaimed an undesirable organization, and basically everybody had to flee the country, because if you deal with an undesirable organization, that's potentially a criminal sentence in prison. And then I think last night, another investigative outlet, Vazhnaya Istoriya, which is Important Stories, was also proclaimed an undesirable organization, but they are already out of the country, because probably, I mean, by now, pretty much all or almost all Russian independent journalists are out. So, yeah.
Well, I think a lot of our audience are really interested in your take as a journalist and observer on the situation inside Russia. And to what extent is the Russian public insulated and isolated from what's actually happening in Ukraine? Are they getting any independent or objective assessments from there? Or obviously the demonstrations, people are getting some information. The demonstrations are heartwarming.
I think the most correct answer would be we don't know. Personally, I don't know anybody who supports the war, like literally no one. And I have thousands of Facebook friends, whatever, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. Of course they exist. And even like an independent surveys, unfortunately show that the majority of the population probably supports this war, even though we don't know, like, even though they get all their information from the television run by the state, which doesn't even call it a war. You know, it's now a
special military operation.
Yeah, it's special military operation, and it's like from starting from Friday, it's a criminal offense to call it a war, like literally. So when people are now being persecuted for just writing on the walls like no war, no to war, because it's considered misinformation, it's considered a fake.
Would they be arrested if they painted up no to special military operation?
That's a good question, actually. I don't know. It's actually a good question. I don't know. I don't think anybody has tried that because it feels wrong, right? Because you accept the language thrust upon you by the government. But it might be actually an interesting. I mean, it's easy to laugh sitting here in another country. Actually, like, people risk a lot of stuff going out on the streets and. As you see, like, I'm not there, I'm here. So they're very aware. But you have to understand, like, there are not that many people on the streets, but that's because street protest has been basically banned for many years. And by right now, it's illegal to even, like, a solitary, like if one person comes out on the street with just some kind of paper that says, you know, no to war, it doesn't say it's no to war, it just says, you know, like.
But when we see these demonstrations, it's noticeable that they don't walk on the road, they walk along the sidewalk, which are presumably the police can't say, no, you can't walk along the sidewalk. So does somebody coordinate that tens of thousands of people walk along in tandem, in concert, along the same sidewalk at the same time? Is somebody organizing this, or is it some?
No, yes. So street politics, again, has been dismantled by the government. And by now, many people feels like they were doing it kind of maybe preparing for the war. Nobody knows, because many people say, I mean, even people in like high circles say that was Putin's decision and nobody knew about that in advance. We don't know. But anyway, street protests has been slowly killed over the last, 5-6 years. So basically people who can organize protests effectively are either in jail or abroad.
But somebody has arranged these sort of pedestrian walkabouts.
Self-organization, like on Facebook, on Telegram channels. There are some. Sorry, this is my son, Timothy. Some like people just this is just self-organization. Literally, there are no leaders. There are no like leaders of the opposition.
So this is done through social media.
Yes, this is done through social media, yes. And this is just, you know, for some people, again, unfortunately, there are not many of them. It's cool that you say that, you know, you see them, but there are like several thousands, maybe 10,000 all over the country, which is not many. This is definitely not enough to, I don't know, like dethrone Putin or crush the police or whatever. But these are people that are basically used to that kind of stuff. They have been going on the streets for years. for different reasons. You know, when Navalny was jailed, they spontaneously, basically without a lot of coordination. I mean, there was some posts for example, from Navalny's account in Instagram or wherever, you know, guys, let's go at the main square of your city, 7 p.m. But frankly, this is, I don't think that counts as real organization. This is mostly spontaneous because, I mean, people who are against the war, they're devastated. They feel like me, and like my life as I knew it has ended 10 days ago, basically. You know, like I feel like everything I have been doing professionally for the past 20 years was for nothing. I mean, I know that it, rationally, I know that's not true, but I really feel that way. It's really horrible. I mean,
I must advise you not to despair. There have been previous exiles from Russia who've gone back and done things. Not always good things.
No, of course. It's not about exile. It's just, you know, like we all of us, all like people I've worked with and my fellow journalists, my, I don't know, like writers, whoever, musicians, we all, I think, thought that everything that we've been doing basically cries, basically like says that, you know, is against the war. It basically, I mean, at the very heart of it, it's about, you know, be kind, not be don't be evil, don't wage wars, stuff like that. It's just very, very elementary stuff. And now we're in the reality where the country, which I used to call my country, I'm kind of learning not to do it now because I don't feel it.
Well, Kieran McGrath from the Express is touching on this. How optimistic are you about the ability of journalists to get the message of what's happening through to the people of Russia? And will they listen if you don't?
Not optimistic at all, unfortunately, because again, it turns out, I mean, we thought again, like up until February 24th, I think we thought that, well, I will oversimplificate, obviously, because it's hard to get into nuances in a dialogue like this. But basically, we thought that, you know, television might be working for some people, but it's so ridiculously, it's basically their lies are so obvious that it cannot, you know, take over people or something like that, that the truth will come out, blah, 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 some stuff like it. And now, basically, the reality tells us that we were wrong and the state apparatus was right. They were just pushing all these lies towards people. And now, again, I'm sorry that I'm going in circles, but back to where I said, I don't know personally anybody who's for war, but my mother, for example, she's against the war, fortunately, and I'm very fortunate about in this because, you know, I know many people who have really, really tough conversations. Who, like, I know somebody to whom their father said, you know, I don't know, you are not my son anymore, because you support these Nazis in Ukraine and blah, 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 and all this bullshit propaganda that he heard on the TV. And he is more willing to believe the television than his own son or daughter. And this is, I think there was a story in New York Times or I think it was in New York Times like today or yesterday about people in Ukraine who has like relatives in Russia, and they call their relatives in Russia and say, you know, we're being bombed. This is a war, and the relatives from Russia say, "Yeah, no, you're like, you're being lied to. It's all a provocation. It's all staged. It's all fake. There is no war. This is a special military operation. We are free in Ukraine from Nazis." Blah blah. So, of course, we, like me and other like dozens, hundreds of journalists, some from Russia, mostly most of us probably. From abroad, we'll continue our work. We'll continue to write the truth to the best of our ability. But honestly, I don't think there is a great chance that, you know, it matters. like in terms of like this millions of people who tens of millions of people who support the war because they watch television. Unfortunately, I mean, the only thing we can do right now is to face the reality. The reality is very harsh. It's very bad. And like the fact is, I don't think independent journalism, especially now that we like somebody in Russia to read the BBC or Medusa or whoever, they now first have to find a VPN service, and to do that they have to know what VPN is, and you have to be to have like lots of competences just in terms of like using the internet to be able to do this. Unfortunately, honestly, I mean, until for somehow the Russian television is taken over by honest people, or is just destroyed somehow. I don't know how. I hope, hopefully, that doesn't happen. Because
one of the narratives is coming out to some extent, and you've alluded to it, is that the sort of intelligentsia knows what's happening.
Yes,
and then have means of access. But what about the ordinary, the people who end up being conscripted into the army, the people who end up in the police and being pushed into the war zone? Are they equally
impervious? I think basically the official narrative is there are no conscripts. This is all done by professionals. Actually, I don't think we have a I think this is actually almost true, as in there are conscripts who are after 4 months in the military offered a contract and they become a professional soldiers, but of course they are not really professionals because 4 months in the army, in the Russian army in the army doesn't make you a professional warrior, right? Because for every job you have to train, and usually more than 4 months. So, but again, unfortunately, and I wouldn't even believe myself if somebody was saying the same thing to me like 2 weeks ago, I would say no, that it's oversimplification, it doesn't work like that. But it looks like people are willing to believe that, you know, their like actual sons are sent into a war to die or to fight like civilians or for no understandable gain or purpose. Like they're willing to believe it only if they actually, you know, their son like phones them or he is killed, and even this, you know, like this is the war of 21st century, so we have a lot of conflicting information. Like the Ukrainian side says that they killed, I think by now, like around 7,000 soldiers. The Russian side accepted several days ago 500 dead soldiers, which is a lot. I was surprised by that because I actually was starting to think that they will, to the end, they will say that, you know, we have no casualties or whatever. They accepted 500, that 500 Russian soldiers were killed. But still...
How effective is the Ukrainian... It seemed quite sophisticated, the idea of the hotline for Russian parents to find out... Cool,
but again, children. I mean, yes, this is... And I have to, like... all the communication that the Ukrainian side does around the war is just very, very professional. And like Russia, I don't know. I hope Russia loses the actual war, but Russia has immediately lost the information war. They just, it's Fortunately, I'm glad about that because, yeah, I don't want Russia to win in any war, which it started. So, yeah, but again, this is a great project, but I'm not sure it's effective in terms of like, I'm not sure there are like, I don't know, like even hundreds of Russian parents who actually called this hotline. So this was a great project, but I'm not sure it's working. And again, like, for example, on Facebook, which is already, again, is already banned in Russia too, but before it was banned, since the start of the war, almost all ads on Russian Facebook were about, you know, were about the war and basically saying that, you know, war is awful, please rise, go to the streets, protest this, or, you know, your sons are dying in this war, or something like the economic crisis will be awful, so please protest, something like that. They were like, I saw, I don't know, dozens of different ads like that, which is, I think, also a part of information campaign. And it's cool, but again, I'm not sure it's working because yeah, apparently, at least in Russia, television easily wins over all of it. And apparently, even in the 21st century, if you push nonsense, really, I mean, I'm not really like nonsense down people's throats long enough, they start to believe it.
Are these strictures applied to the printed press as well, or is that irrelevant?
Yes, of course. I mean, yes and yes. Yes, it is irrelevant because the print press is just minuscule compared to television, even internet. But yes, in terms of a handful, like there are no independent Russian newspapers anymore. Yeah, like all of them are in one way or another, like controlled by the government or somebody. Or controlled by somebody who is...
Slobodan Milosevic had the last word on this. He was asked why in Belgrade he allowed a free press. And he said, the people who support me don't read newspapers. I control the television, which I think summed it up.
Which is smart. I mean, evil, but smart. But, you know, in Russia, it's not even like that anymore. Newspapers are as controlled as anything. And until the war, there was this, here's like a case which is very, very illustrative and sad and interesting. So there was this radio station, Echo of Moscow, Echo Moskvy, that was positioning itself as an independent station. And it was run by this guy, Alexei Venediktov, who likes to be friends with elites, who like personally communicates with, not with Putin, of course, but with like the prime minister or some other guys. He likes to be near those who are in power. And it looked like that they were keeping this station for this particular purpose that you mentioned, that, you know, that they could always say,
see, there is protest.
Yeah, there is a protest right here. So they could always say, you know, why are you saying that there is no freedom of speech in Russia? Here is Echo in Moscow. They can say anything they want, which was not true, but to a certain extent, it was true. Now, again, the Echo of Moscow was the first media that was closed after the war started. A week after the war started, they just closed it like in a day. And all this friendship that this editor-in-chief had with all the powerful people, it didn't help at all. They just and it was also owned. It was also owned by Gazprom Media, so it's owned basically by the state-run gas corporation. And you know, nothing helped. They just closed it in a day, and there isn't. Then they just took it off the air like. In an hour, that was just incredible, actually, honestly, because everybody thought, you know, these guys, they're so like between between the how do you call it in English? So basically, they are sitting on two chairs at the same time. They always will be able to
hedge their bets,
some kind of compromise. Yes, and then they just destroyed it in a day, and you know, over with it. So by now, there is nobody even like pretends that there is freedom of speech in Russia. I mean, of course, when they're saying something, they of course say, you know, this is like they were required to abide by law, like no, blah blah blah. But basically, all masks are off by now. Like nobody even pretends that Russia is a democratic country. Yeah.
What about the effect that the justification for sanctions? It's twofold. The financial sanctions are aimed at the oligarchs and the powerful people you mentioned earlier. But I mean, whether intentional or not, the real effect has got to be on the economy of the country and ordinary people. So to what extent do the oligarchs, are the oligarchs hurting, and will do they have any power or leverage with Putin and the Kremlin?
I'm no expert, honestly. So this will be just my thoughts. I don't think the term oligarch is actually relevant in Putin's Russia. It was relevant in the 90s, where like some businessmen had definitely a lot of influence on the government, on the president, Boris Yeltsin. So that was literally oligarchs, as you know, as in
a powerful political group.
As in a dictionary. Now, I don't think any businessman, like they are all dependent on Putin. So anybody, like any billionaire, can lose it immediately if he goes against the government. I think so. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. So these are not oligarchs. They are just wealthy people who I don't know what they're thinking. I mean, I think that many of them are enlightened, smart people who are probably as horrified as we are about this, but they cannot do anything. And probably that's how they justify their silence, that, you know, I can't do anything. I cannot risk, I don't know, my freedom, my business, my employees.
Well, they're risking their yachts and their New York apartments and their...
But I'm not sure. Yes, and I think, I mean, I don't. This is probably a right thing to do in these circumstances, to confiscate all this. But I'm not sure, like what scenario there could be, like that. Alisher Usmanov, this is the guy whose yacht was confiscated. Like what he actually can do, I'm not sure. Like I don't know. Another thing, these sanctions will definitely hurt. I mean, like also it's important to remember that we're in an uncharted territory here, you know, because like basically in all aspects. So I have no idea what will happen with the Russian economy. This is unprecedented, you know, because everybody mentions North Korea these days, but North Korea has always been this closed country that, you know, built its own support system, however fragile and bad. But, you know, Russia had I think it's in the past tense by now, was a relatively globally open, integrated, capitalist country, and it isn't anymore. And I'm wrong, but I frankly don't think we have seen anything like that. What happens when you just pull out everything capitalist from a country? I mean, like an hour before our conversation, the spokesperson of the ruling party, United Russia, said, you know, let's nationalize all the factories of the businesses that pulled out of Russia. I wouldn't be surprised if they did that. So I have no idea what will happen, but that will that will be have a blow on everybody in Russia or outside of Russia. I'm pretty sure, like, I have been, I don't know, an upper middle class guy, I think, before they started. Now I hope I'll survive, at least, and our family survives. So
what was about ordinary people? I mean, if you go,
ordinary people, all the supermarket people, basically. So a lot of this is about, again, there's again everywhere there's a lot to unpack here. It's all very much connected with the fall of Soviet Union, the trauma of that fall, the grudge that the Russian state had, and you know, many of Russian people I think actually had against the West, and
they had some valid reasons to do so, but there's no reason to take it out on the Ukraine.
Yeah, absolutely. They had, but I mean, it doesn't mean that the war is justified. Obviously, nothing can justify a war. But yeah, so what I'm trying to say here is that, yes, it will hit hard, but I'm not sure that it will change anything politically in Russia, because there are two ways of thinking about that I think many Russian people will apply. First is one, you know, there is this proverb in Russia, we never lived well, so let's not even start, basically. So basically it's just, you know, like, it's always been bad, so it's bad again.
We fall from a low point. It's not a long way.
We survived through the 90s, there were like bad economy, and so we will survive this. I don't know if they are right. Maybe they won't, but the attitude definitely is there. Another attitude is basically is this very, very old school kind of nationalist patriotic ideology that says, you know, it doesn't matter if you individually doesn't live well, if your life sucks, it matters that, you know, Russia has established its pride, has, you know, like...
ask not what your country does for you, ask what you can do for your country.
Yeah, sort of. Yes. It doesn't matter if we live... if our life is poor, and but you know, we show to the world that, you know, we are mighty and whatever. And again, of course, we did not show to the world that we are mighty. We just showing to the world that we are evil and irrational, and like any bad adjective that you can find. But people are being told on TV that, you know, now they will respect us, now they will fear us. Russia has finally, you know, established that it won't be messed with. And yeah, so, and again, we're in uncharted territory here, because in the end of it, Russia does have nuclear weapons. So there's only so much that...
How do Russians take it that Vladimir Putin has overtly threatened to use...
I'm horrified, and everybody I know were horrified. I mean, I was literally Googling bomb shelters around my house in Moscow when he did this speech on Sunday, I think last Sunday, you know, saying that, you know, remember, like, we could always use a nuke. But
I saw one of the pet TV stations, they were actually discussing the use of tactical nukes to... Presumably to save the Russians in Ukraine.
I've always thought that was just posturing, that all these people in the state TV are just, you know, like, are just boasting and just provocating, just that there's nothing under it. But by now, I don't know, maybe all this bullshit about, you know, like, we can turn the United States into a nuclear dust was for real. And for, like, I don't know what to think anymore. So yeah, please understand that I don't know how ordinary people in Russia feel. I know a lot of people, but I wouldn't say that I mean, nobody I know likes what's happening. Everybody's horrified. Everybody's like thinking how to leave or yeah, but this is a harsh fact of reality that there are lots of people who are okay with it, at least. Like, there are lots of people who are just, you know, this is politics that doesn't concern me. Still, even when, because that's what TV tell them, you know, this is just like some special operation. You know, this is like, one day in Moscow, when I was trying to get some cash, I think, from a bank, I heard this woman talking on the phone, and she said, you know, yeah, I've got all these problems, and also now this stupid war, you know, this, like, she was treating it not as an existential threat, not as, I mean, again, I don't know what she thinks, that's what I heard, but as it was just a minor discomfort.
No storm, one of these things, you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, like, you know, like they involve this like a traffic jam, a war, whatever.
This is almost unfair, but Mark Seddon has just piped up to ask if your namesake, Mikhail Gorbachev, spoken. Has he said anything about the war, what for or against, or is he?
He definitely, he is 90 something now, so he's very old. He definitely said something against the nukes, and I think he said something against the war. But Mikhail Gorbachev has been extremely unpopular in Russia since the late 80s. So, unfortunately, nobody listens to him. Like, even though I respect him, and many people I know respect him and think that he's the only Russian leader in the last, I don't know, 300 years who willingly stepped down and did not create, as Yeltsin, his, did not give power to who he wanted to. He just stepped down and, you know, okay, like, democratic process.
That moves on to the other question is, does the Tsar have any succession plans?
Yeah, that's not me to ask. We don't know. I don't know. I don't think I'm entitled to comment on that. I have no idea. It looks like, I mean, again, until February 24th, I thought that Putin is evil, absolutely, that he has completely different values than me, stuff like that. But I thought he was a rational actor. I don't think that anymore. I think he's, I would say that, I think that his perception of reality is definitely distorted. I cannot exclude that he honestly thinks that they are fighting the Nazis in Ukraine, that he is basically, to a certain extent, a victim of his own propaganda, because it feels like he really believes it. I don't know, because it's hard to think about succession now, because nobody can even fathom what's the end game in Ukraine is. What do they want to do? Okay, let's say, and I hope that doesn't happen, but let's say that they sack Kyiv, right? That they, you know, that they take over the country. What do they do next? The people in Ukraine will never accept whoever they, like, do they just, because of that, it might be, I think, that Putin honestly thinks that people in Ukraine want to be liberated. I don't know. So, yeah, it's hard to talk about the plans of a man who does seem to be irrational and does seem to live in a different reality.
Well, we have another question from Kieran McGrath about Russian sports stars. And that's been, that was highlighted by the gymnast who had the Z on his T-shirt, which I think was a trifle provocative, since it's not a recognized.
It is awful, but I mean, yeah. But actually, the war, like, usually Russian media figures, sports stars, show business, singers, actors, either support what government does or don't comment. The war is another matter, proved to be another matter, because basically lots of pro-government Russian stars stepped out and said, no, this is not okay. The war is not okay. They, like, not many of them directly accused Putin of anything, but many, like, literally the dozens of media figures who are usually silent or loyal said, you know, no to war. War is bad. Let's end the war. Even Alexander Ovechkin, who was like on Putin team and the biggest hockey player who plays in Washington Capitals, even he posted something like no to war. And like there is this actor, Daniil Kozlovsky, who posted a huge on his Instagram, a huge basically speech saying that what's happening is horrible. It shouldn't be happening. Please stop it, Mr. President. He even directly addressed Putin. But of course, there are people and sportsmen too and who approve of it for the same reasons I think that I mentioned earlier. And also...
Okay, we hear your cries, child.
Yeah, that's my son and my soul also, you know. I'm crying a lot these days. I'm kind of... the fact that I'm stable during this conversation is probably because you are a great moderator and I'm on good pills. But so sportsmen in Russia, as in the United States, I think, are trained to be patriots. So so they are basically trained in the logic, you know, and this is actually also the logic of many people, I think. You know, our government may not be right, but we can, like, when we wage a war, we cannot oppose it. You know, you can, like, I literally saw one guy wrote, you know, yeah, it's awful, but you cannot go against your army. You have to support your army. I don't support this logic at all, but there is this logic.
Well, we had a lot of it here during the Gulf War. My country, right or wrong, yes, my president calls, etc., etc. So we know where of you speak.
I honestly think Russia and America are similar in many ways. But, I mean, in America, the constitution works, and in Russia, it doesn't. So, and this is a big difference, unfortunately. So sportsmen, yeah, they are basically raised like soldiers to a certain extent. So, it's not surprising at all that, and this guy, I think, is what, 18 years old. He lost to a Ukrainian. So, obviously, along with the politics, he had this probably bitterness over the fact that he lost to a Ukrainian guy. So, yeah. But honestly, this is something like in all this darkness, this is something that one can hang on to.
Does this have an effect on Russian people? Do Russian people hear about it? This is where we're getting to. It's like a tree falling in the forest.
I'm not sure. But I mean, people who follow these guys, and there are some very, very popular guys on Instagram or on Facebook. It's usually on Instagram, actually. They hear about it. And a lot of people started writing hateful comments, you know, like, you're just an actor, just stop it, it's not your job. And
sounds like football players taking the knee for Black Lives Matter.
Just play the ball, as they told to LeBron James, I think, whatever. Definitely people heard about it, but again, this, they don't talk about it on TV. And actually, one of the first guys to oppose the war was this this anchor of the late night show on the First Channel, which is the biggest channel in Russia. And it's a good late night show. It's basically made in the vein of all the American late night shows, so Stephen Colbert, Jimmy Fallon, whoever, and it's a good show, really. It's important for Russian culture. So he and the guy
is
who,
he still hosting the show, or has he been moved?
Now, well, yeah, so okay, so let me finish the story. So in the first day, February 24th, he posts this post, you know, saying like, no to war, it's awful, something like that. Again, I don't think he mentioned Putin, he just said no to war. And some of his co-anchors basically made the same point, and they stopped broadcasting it. But we don't know. And I think this was his last public appearance, but we don't know. I cannot say that. I mean, he's probably somewhere abroad, just as myself. I don't think they, you know, put him in jail or whatever.
No. Not in the Lubyanka, as he would have been.
No. I mean, no, but he probably left Russia, I think. I'm not sure. I don't know. And they say that they are not putting this show, they're not broadcasting this show because this is no time for late night shows. The country has, you know, like,
should be up early to make the war.
Special military operation going on, and they just basically canceled all the entertainment stuff, which makes sense, actually. So, and a guy I know who I think works at this show, he said that they haven't been told that, you know, it's over. So maybe they return at some point. I don't know. But the fact is, yeah, he said that he's against the war, and the show hasn't been broadcasted since.
Silence since then.
But still, it might be broadcasted later. I don't know. Yes.
Well, look, Alexander, we've been keeping you away from your child crying from the depths there for an hour now. So I think we should be winding up. And I want to remind people, I've been getting the questions coming in. I've been trying to summarize and put them. And in fairness to Alexander, he's not been dodging them. But it was clear that he didn't really feel qualified to answer geopolitical questions about Turkey, China, etc.
So we've
concentrated on what Russians feel, what Russians are experiencing, which is, as a journalist, his major field of expertise.
It's important. I'd like to make this point. You know, I'm not a political analyst. I'm not a political journalist even. I'm an editor, and I think I'm a good editor, and I can speak to whatever journalists in Russia feel like. Journalists in Russia, or Russian journalists, because there are not many journalists in Russia left. But I cannot attest to what Putin plans are or whatever. And actually, another point I want to make, if anybody says he knows, that's mostly bullshit, because like by now, I think nobody knows what's in this man's head. And it always has been his unpredictability has always been an important part of his strategy within the country, because you never knew, would they come next for another journalist, or they just, because they, like, some publication were, you know, like, designated foreign agents, some weren't. Nobody knew what's the logic here. And it was important to, you know, put people under constant pressure, actually, because you never know what happens next. There is no obvious logic, but now it's just rational, so nobody really knows what's in his mind, and that's frightening, and that's horrifying. So yeah,
it's just me, but he does uncannily remind me of Gollum in Lord of the Rings, my precious. But that's just my
sense. You know, there was this kind of media scandal when some people noticed that Dobby in Harry Potter in the films was really like looked similar to Putin. I think maybe even like Russian foreign affairs minister commented on that it was unethical to do whatever. I mean, obviously nobody meant to. Like, Dobby is a kind, caring creature who actually sacrifices himself for Harry Potter, so he's like absolutely not similar to Putin in any way, and even Gollum.
Any resemblances are purely coincidental.
Yes, and even Gollum, I think, has more soul left in him. Even, but you know, it's interesting. It's an interesting analogy, because one of the biggest Russian writers, Vladimir Sorokin, he published this op-ed in the Guardian last Saturday, I think. Where he actually explains the corruption of Putin's mind and soul through the analogy with Lord of the Rings, and through the analogy that, you know, that he got this ring of power, and initially he might have wanted to do some good, but this power just corrupted him. It might be true. I don't know, but if you can read this, so bad, it's a very dark article, but it's written by a great writer. So,
yeah. Well, it's really is coming. We have to thank you for agreeing to do this at a time when it looked like it could be almost a kamikaze move as a journalist. When you were still in Moscow, I'm pleased you're out, and welcome to the protester in the background, and your wife into Istanbul and the West.
Absolutely. I will. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for.
Maybe you can go down to the Bosphorus and wave at the Russian warships being queuing to get through.
I think they banned them under certain
conditions. It's worth looking into while you're there as a journalist. But I'd like to thank you from the Foreign Press Association, and please get in touch if we can do any more. I should point out that one of our other awardees and previous panelist, Holly McKay, is actually in Kiev, and we're trying to get hold of her for an impending.
I hope
series.
She's all right. I hope she's all
well.
Right.
She did. Yeah. She did. She was actually in Afghanistan when all about her had fled. So this is journalism at its best. So thank you for what you've done.
Actually another thing I wanted to say, that, you know, with it's really like our hardships are nowhere, like, it's not even comparable with what people in Ukraine feel, you know. So I don't even think I have a right to, you know, complain about being forced to leave Russia or whatever. Like, people lose their homes, their relatives, they have to flee, like, with on their, like, just walk towards the border. This is awful, and all of us kind of bear some responsibility. So yeah, I it's just important for me to underline it too, that, you know, like,
we should remember that as we're sort of exulting at a Russian helicopter coming down, there's whole apartment blocks of people who have now been made homeless, and there are needs, humanitarian needs, as well as our thoughts about the military. So thank you very much again, all of you.
Thank you very much.
Look up the Foreign Press Association, join us, donate so we can keep this work going. Looking forward to trying to get Holly McKay again, and lots of people coming in and saying thank you on the chat box. And do keep in touch if there's anything that we can do to help you. After all, we own you as an awardee of the Foreign Press Association.
We'll see. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. And I hope I hope this war ends soon. Even though there is only hope. There is no. I mean, yeah. I hope so. Thank you.
Okay. Спасибо, Alexander. Bye.